Welcome. I think this is one of the most important topics on which we could all spend some time, and that is how to teach gospel doctrine. And I am absolutely delighted with this panel because we have multiple perspectives. When I called Mark and he began talking about stages of faith, I just bells lit. I've been very much a believer that we have to teach to many different people on many different levels of faith. And I'm always glad to be with Albert and appreciate his work. And I know he loves gospel doctrine. And Margaret also has. I think her class is famous because the fame has reached Seattle. That must be a definition of famous. many people who had visited down here come back and, oh, I got to go to a gospel doctrine class that was really wonderful. And Margaret, I am without bios for you all. Brian did not hand those to me, so would you mind telling us all a little bit about your background so that I'm not incorrect with details? And Mark, would you like to begin?
I'll take it that wasn't really a yes-no question. I'm Mark Edward Koltko, and I'm a psychotherapist on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, not actually in Greenwich Village, which makes me immediately suspect, I'm sure. I think I'm here partly because Brian Waterman, who helped organize the symposium as well as the demonstrations at BYU in regards to the Conchar, Farr, and Knowlton affair, happened to be in my classes some years earlier when he was a missionary in my branch. So I don't know whether that makes me a co-conspirator or whether what I truly feel for him is a great deal of pride. My own approach towards teaching, though, it greatly comes out of certain elements of my background that perhaps you should know about. First of all, as an investigator, I had the great example of a fellow named Larry Kurtz in the Kingston ward in upstate New York. Larry, as the gospel's essential teacher, took the position that he would answer any question whatsoever. Nothing that I could bring up would be out of bounds, and he would take time out individually, right through opening exercises of Sunday school under the old schedule, and long afterwards, after class, to go through whatever it is I had to bring up. I was never belittled. Secondly, a couple of months after I joined the church, I was called to teach the gospel doctrine class. So I didn't have much time to be indoctrinated in the mainstream ways of approaching things. Kind of grateful for that. Thirdly, in my work in psychology, I've become very interested in theories in the psychology of religion. And I'm thinking particularly of James Fowler's work in terms of stages of faith development. His basic position, like that of many developmental theorists, is that different people need different things at different stages in order to promote their own optimal development. So because of that, because of all these elements, I've come to a small number of basic underlying principles that guide my work, and a larger number of very practical teaching principles that I'll share with you. The underlying principles I have are really three in number. First of all, truth need not fear. Secondly, the full truth will only strengthen faith. And thirdly, people need to investigate and wrestle with tough questions to grow and develop truly strong faith, the way that they need to wrestle with hard weights or heavy physical activity to truly develop strong physical bodies. Now, in terms of teaching principles, well, those are a bit more in number. First of all, as a teacher, I pick the direction of the discussion, but I do not dictate the conclusions that that discussion must reach. Next, as again I take from Larry Kurtz, absolutely any question is valid. If I, as the teacher, need to shelve a question to stay more or less in this direction rather than a very different one, sure, I'll shelve it, but I will always take it off the shelf and I will always deal with it, even if I have to do that individually after class, until the point where the individual says, yes, you've dealt with my question. Next, the issue comes up. You know, people make assertions in class. And the question comes up, what is acceptable as evidence to back up a statement that somebody says? The closest thing that I will call proof in class is not only scripture, but a scripture that someone can find. I'm very picky about that. A person can use anything else as evidence, but that evidence is thereby purely personal opinion. That includes general authority writings, general authority opinions, downright folk tales, family traditions. As long as it's clearly labeled as opinion or as such, they can say it. But the only thing that is close to proof would be scripture, and even that, it is understood, can be interpreted in very different ways. They also have to be able to find that scripture, yes. I feel that I'm responsible for setting an environment for learning. But the class members are responsible for their own learning. And I set that out right at the beginning. Instead of using the stick approach and punishing people for not being prepared, or instead of taking the idea that somehow the class members are passive receptacles of learning, into which I, you know, in my brilliance will pour the knowledge. I reject that completely. I tell them, if you want to have an interesting and useful time in this class, then what you'll do is you'll be prepared ahead of time. You'll go over the material. You might even come up with questions to bring up, because we're going to have a long discussion, and it's going to be really boring if you're not ready to deal with it. And since most of my teaching involves throwing questions out to people, I'll just sit there happily in front of the class until somebody engages. It only takes a certain number of very long, interminable silences before people get the idea, he's serious, he's dangerous, I'd better be ready for the material. Okay. About discussion. I like to spend at least 80% of class time in discussion. If you're teaching gospel doctrine, the people are fully capable of reading through the basic material, unless you're teaching people for whom English is really not a comfortable language, and then one makes special allowances, and one has to actually teach the material in terms of conveying the facts. But basically, I encourage discussion. But I recognize certain things. And we'll talk for a while just on discussion. One thing I recognize is that many great and important things are yet to be revealed. But an inescapable corollary of that is that there are many and great and important questions which cannot be definitively answered now. What does that mean? It's okay for me to admit that I don't have an answer to that question. It's okay to say that we may not have answers even to very important questions. Learning to deal with ambiguity, places where we still see through a glass darkly, is part of growing up to be a mature Christian. Another point on discussion is, the journey is more important than the destination. You sometimes hear in the church about the unity of the faith. Well, that unity consists much more in the attitudes that we take towards each other, towards the questions that come up. The unity of the faith has nothing to do with some kind of artificial unanimity of answers. Another point relating to discussion. Discussion is fine. Argument is intolerable. There may be a fine line between the two, but one can find it. And I am shamelessly blatant in pulling it towards discussion and away from purely argument. When different sides come up in a discussion, I make it a point to take all of them. Because all of them have some truth to them, regardless of what they are. It may be difficult to find that truth, but that's why you're teaching. Your job, in a sense, is to find the truth in the position. Okay? Leaving the matter of just class discussions now and other points on teaching, being a saint is hard. Living the basics of the gospel is hard. I focus on the basics of gospel living and hard real-life applications. So in my classes, we'll talk about things like drug addiction, prostitution, economic inequities, cancer, four-year-olds with inoperable brain tumors. And we'll bring up the tough stuff that hits every family in the church. Another principle in teaching. Sunday school is Sunday school. Sunstone Symposia are Sunstone Symposia. I try to be appropriate to each. I feel that part of being a Sunday school teacher does mean that I am responsible to represent church doctrine. The other hand of that is that I'm not responsible to represent or give any credence to general authority opinions or folklore or fantasies or whatever it is along those lines. I have a very, you know, that which is truly doctrine is actually a much smaller circle than the circle drawn by manuals or folklorists, shall I say, in the church. Another point for teaching, be aware of where people are and teach for that level. Some people, regardless of their chronological age or the number of years they've been in the church, still have a very young faith, maybe because of arrested development. They need answers. But most people are not so young in the faith. They don't need answers. They need questions. They need questions to wrestle with, and they need methods with which to wrestle with them. And our jobs as teachers is to give people those questions and those methods for wrestling with them. I would also suggest as a point, it's important to be respectful to everyone. Easy to say, not so easy to do. I'm thinking of someone who shows up in my classes fairly regularly, who I'll call Peter. Peter did a lot of drugs in the 60s. It shows. He will regularly bring in material from way out in left field. He also reads voluminously, which means that he will bring in material that's actually quite erudite. It's just hard to tell sometimes. Right? I mean, there's no predictability. It may be brilliant. It may be bizarre. It may be both. Peter is never belittled in classes. Okay? It's the payoff from that. You know, his questions may need to be shelved, or we may deal with them right as they are, right in class. And sometimes, if I shelve them, I always bring them up and talk with him after class. The payoff for that is that Peter is sometimes the only person in class who can deal with some of the very difficult material that comes up when it comes to trying to live as a Mormon Christian. People also talk in class out of pain. They take the positions they take out of fear. Be tender with those things. When you teach, take your shoes off. You're treading on sacred ground. The comments that people bring up in class are sort of a spiritual Rorschach that way, and will tell you a lot about their pain and fear. In conclusion, I'd like to give a quotation by that famous humanist, Brigham Young. There is one principle I wish to urge upon the saints in a way that it may remain with them, and that is to understand men and women as they are and not as you are. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Margaret Toscano. Just a little bit of background on me. I've given a lot of presentations at Sunstone. I co-author a book called Strangers in Paradox with my husband Paul Toscano. I'm currently working on a PhD at the U in Comparative Literature and Languages. My dissertation deals with sex and God. So, as Molly mentioned, I taught gospel doctrine in my class, in my current ward, which is here in Salt Lake City. I taught for a little bit over 2 years. For most of that time, I was team teaching with Fred Voros, who is a good friend, also a contributor to Sunstone. He's written articles, so you may be familiar with him. Our class was a little bit unorthodox, but most of the ward really liked it. I was released from the position on the Sunday that my husband was excommunicated. I wasn't there. I was at the vigil waiting for the verdict on Paul. I heard later from a woman, and I don't know if this was simply an oversight, she was rather angry about it, that they didn't give me a vote of thanks. So I'm not sure what that means. So the first question that I would like to ask, and I hope that after we give our presentations that we have some time to discuss, my basic question right now is it possible to teach spiritual, thought-provoking lessons in the church without clashing with authoritarian leaders and members? Is it possible? Now, some of you may have been at the session last hour with Megan Hansen, who was talking about boredom in the church. And I think that we have this real problem with boredom in the church. On the other hand, as my husband made his comment at the end of the class, that I think sometimes the purpose of the correlation program is to promote boredom. And so I have this question, you know, if you have an innovative, spiritually stimulating class, are you going to inevitably have some kind of a clash with authoritarianism? Now, I think I should also say at this point that I agree very much with what Mark said, which is that Sunday school is Sunday school and sunstone is sunstone. And I always felt that as a gospel doctrine teacher, I had a responsibility to be both thought-provoking, but also to be sensitive to people's spiritual needs and to what they needed and to where they were. And I did not feel that I should use gospel doctrine to bring up some of the more controversial things that I'm interested in. For example, I never talked about women in the priesthood. Although I did give one lesson on the fullness of the priesthood where I brought in a quote from Joseph Smith and one from Brigham Young and just let the quote stand on their own merit. And I thought that was appropriate for the lesson that we were dealing with. But I didn't try to use the Sunday school as a soapbox for my particular issues. I felt very much that there's a sacred trust involved there and that I have a responsibility to try to teach the gospel in the gospel doctrine class. Now, as I taught this class, one of the things that I found is that there's a real tension inside members. And I think that this is one of the problems in teaching the class. It seems like the members want two contradictory things. On the one hand, I find that members are bored and they're tired of the same old gospel doctrine lessons that they've had year after year and hearing the things that they've heard since primary. They want to hear something new. They want to be interested in this thing. They want to have more knowledge and fresh insights. On the other hand, there's also this desire for certainty. And certainly the whole correlation program and other things in the church very much reinforce that desire for certainty. And so we have this tension. On the one hand, people don't want to be bored, they want new knowledge, but they're also afraid of believing things that are not authorized. So at the same time, they're hungry for spiritual food, knowledge, and a place to discuss their religion, but many are afraid to have a discussion which ends without a sure answer to the question. Another thing I found is that because of the authoritarian structure of the church, that many members are afraid to say what they really feel. I remember that I gave one lesson on the word of wisdom. And it was, I think, a rather thought-provoking lesson. What I had done in the lesson is I started out with a question asking, is there a difference between church practice or church policy and eternal principles? Is it possible that we can have a rule in the church that's a rule for the church but may not be an eternal law? And so I started out the gospel doctrine with the word of wisdom on this, and I said, you know, there had been other dispensations when they didn't have the word of wisdom. I mean, Jesus did drink wine after all, right? And we got into a discussion about that, in fact. Well, I thought it was a very positive discussion. Afterwards, it was very interesting that I must have had four different women who came up and told me that they had an opinion they wanted to tell me, but they had been afraid to say what they really felt in the class because they were afraid that other people in the class would be condemning. For example, one wanted to say that she felt like that there was a lot of hypocrisy in the church, that, you know, someone may be very offended if you drink a cup of coffee, but, you know, all these women are on prescription drugs, right? They're all taking antidepressants. And she said, I just have felt condemned in the ward because of different things. She said, my doctor told me I should drink a cup of coffee, but it's very hard. And that was very interesting to me, to see how often people would come up to me privately afterwards and say things. But there was a fear that they didn't want to feel condemned. Now, one of the things I tried to do in the class is what Mark mentioned, which is that I tried to have an atmosphere of trust and say, you know, anything is okay to say. We can love each other and disagree. It was fairly successful, but not completely. I found that in my Sunday school class, there were a few who intimidated the many. And this is a real problem. How do you deal with a kind of member who always wants to close every discussion with an authoritative quote, which they don't always have a source for? My technique was to ask another question or to say, yes, but what about this? And I'm afraid this didn't endear me to a couple of old men in the ward who were wanting to always have the last word, and I wouldn't let them. One interesting thing that Paul and I did in the class is that we took an anonymous survey to see how the members were feeling about the class. This was about a year and a half after we had started the class. And the results were very informative, I think. One half were very enthusiastic, saying things like this was the best gospel doctrine class they had ever had, that it was so good to have a breath of fresh air. They were very excited. One-fourth liked the class, but had a few complaints and suggestions, mostly practical things, like make this more applicable to our daily lives. I'm never very good at that. By which they meant, give us a list of things to do. Actually, I think I did, and so did Fred. I think we both dealt with real-life problems, but we weren't very good about saying, you know, this is your goal for the week or something. Or some would want some more historical background or something like that. One-fourth were highly critical of what they felt were the unorthodox nature of the class. Some of this group complained we didn't follow the manual. Several of these people complained about my feminist views, which was very interesting because I had never brought them up in class. So it was not based on what I had said in class, but what they had heard through gossip or read in the newspaper or something like that. Now, you see these statistics, there were only a fourth, maybe, who were really unsatisfied. Even though the complaining group was in the minority, they were the group which finally prevailed. Why is it that the complaint of a few can ruin things for the majority in the church? And in fact, afterwards, I can't tell you how many people have told me, oh, I wish you and Fred were back teaching the class. This happens all the time, and I noticed when I was at BYU that this especially happened. One narrow-minded person's complaint is seen as a reason for policy making. I have never understood this. I don't think it is merely because the majority is silent. There seems to be some other dynamic working here, and I would certainly like responses to that. Just another little example. Paul was released from teaching the 15 and 18-year-olds in our ward because two parents complained about a lesson that he'd actually given as a substitute for Fred and me, where he had, it was an interpretation of Jacob in the Book of Mormon, where he said that the real sin, what was your argument, Paul? He was arguing that in the Jacob passage where the polygamy is condemned, that the real issue there was control and holding women as property, not simply sex. Trying to say, you know, we always want to make this sexual, but this has to do with control and domination and power. Well, one of the parents was very upset because he was afraid that Paul wasn't going to be telling his daughter that sex sins, he wanted his daughter told that sex sins are next to murder, and he wanted this reinforced in that class. And he complained, and Paul got released. It's interesting that there was one kid in the class who refused to go back to the Sunday school class until Paul was reinstated. And his complaint was not listened to, but the parent, and there were a lot of kids that stopped going. They had really liked the class. And why does this happen? The bishop also told me after I was released that there were certain people who were constantly complaining to him about my teaching, usually reporting things that I never actually said. He always had his wife who was the, he would ask. After the survey that Fred and I took, we suggested the bishop that he have two gospel doctrine classes so those who didn't like the class could have another choice. And of course, this is a method that's used successfully in other wards. Our bishop didn't want to do this because he felt that one of the purposes of the class was for members to learn to deal with differences, which I, in some ways, I love that idea. Unfortunately, it didn't work altogether well. So without an open-minded, supportive bishop, I think it is impossible to have real innovative teaching in the church. I wouldn't have lasted as long as I did if I hadn't had a supportive bishop. It also helped that Fred and I agreed on approach and doctrine. Fred had been on the High Council and was very respected in the ward. Many people saw Fred and Vicky's family as the ideal. The fact that Fred supported me made a big difference in how I was received. And that was both wonderful and bad. You know, it's wonderful that I had that support, but also bad that a woman has to be validated by the man. So this brings me back to the initial question. Is it possible to have good teaching in an authoritarian system? And I think the answer is no, or at least in a very limited way. And I see this as tragic because I see there's a real hunger. Now, just quickly, I don't know how much time I've taken, but I want to go through a couple of things on content and method in gospel doctrine teaching. What is the purpose of gospel doctrine? As I said, I don't think it's the same as Sunstone Symposium. I feel that one of the most important things is for people to feel the Spirit. And I always try to approach my teaching by calling upon the Spirit. And one of the things I find that brings the Spirit faster than anything is honesty. And so I try to be honest about my own doubts, my own fears, and about everything else. I also think that we should learn new things. This is an important way of escaping boredom. And I think one of the unfortunate things in the church is that we don't stress this idea of stretching our knowledge. I also think another purpose of gospel doctrine is to understand our canon of Scripture. I think it's amazing how that after all the times that we've been through the standard works, that nobody knows the texts. You know, why is this? Another thing I see is that another purpose is converting people to the gospel. I think spiritual rebirth and sanctification are purposes of gospel doctrine, and this can happen, again, if we're honest with our real spiritual experiences and feelings. I also think creating a sense of community and love in the ward, learning how to disagree and still love each other. What should the subject matter be? We'll come to content now. One of the questions I'd like us to discuss as a group is, should the church go through the standard works every 4 years? I think everybody's feeling bored with this, and yet I see a real irony here because we don't know the text. I think there's plenty in our canon that is there for great discussions if we didn't have this very boring approach where we do it the same year after year. If we're going to keep using the standard works, and I think even I'm very much in favor in bringing in other materials, but I still think this, the scriptures should be the basic text. We've got to have other approaches. We've got to do it better. One of the things that I found to be the most successful in my gospel doctrine teaching is to do a very careful analysis of scriptures. One of the things that I find is that members do not know how to read the scriptures. They know we're supposed to read them 15 minutes a day, but understanding them, I mean, that isn't really expected, right? And so sometimes I really like to do the thing where we read the text carefully. I mean, maybe we should take 20 years to get through the scriptures. I don't know. At least it would be better than this sort of thing where, okay, this week it's Isaiah, next week it's Jeremiah, and we have a superficial approach to the whole thing. And I think the problem here is the superficiality of it. I mean, there's so many things we could do. Thematic approaches, a slow reading, literary approach, historical approach. There are so many things that you could do even if we did stick to the scriptures. Now, what about manuals? Should we have manuals? Right now, as most of you probably know, the manual really is not very specific. It gives just a very basic guideline. And I think, in fact, that this is good. The strange thing that I find is, why is it that there's so much complaint about following the manuals when you have two things? First of all, that the manuals have always said that teachers have the right to fit this for their particular group. And secondly, when we have these very sparse manuals, one of the conclusions that I've come to is that people use the follow the manual complaint as a way of beating up a teacher that they don't like, and that really is more the content, or that they have some other complaint. It's not really the manual. It's sort of a smokescreen. It's kind of like, this is a way that I can get this person, when really it's something else that they're concerned with, and they won't really deal with the real issue. What about outside materials? Should we bring in outside materials? I think so. What about other translations of the Bible? This is one of my real pet peeves. I feel that in the church right now, the King James Version of the Bible is what the Latin Bible was to the Catholic Church, that the members understand the King James just about as well as the 16th century or 17th century English people understood the Latin. They don't. And I feel like that we need to have the people read modern versions. This is a problem in the church. I didn't actually do the Old Testament. I did the New Testament. I do some Greek. I would always bring in my Greek and tell them the Greek words, and it intimidates the hell out of them. They don't know what to do when you do that. But, you know, I wasn't trying to do it to show off, but it was a way of saying, let's really look at this text and see what it says. And I find people are just hungry for that. They wanted to understand it. When I brought in another translation, Fred did more than I did. The members really enjoyed it. Again, you might have a few old guys that go, or women, I shouldn't just blame the men, right, who go and complain to the bishop. But I think that this is something we need. Other scholarship. I think that often you can do these things if you approach it sensitively. I found that the members were quite open to some of the new ideas if you didn't hit them over the head with it. If you weren't saying, I'm giving you some higher criticism here, or if you didn't say to them, this is from someplace else, so you did it sensitively, again, they were hungry for new ideas and outside materials were helpful. But you always run into a conflict with the real authoritarian members of the church, so that's a problem. Other relevant books. I remember that when we discussed D&C 25, I brought in Mormon Enigma for talking about Emma. Again, I tried to do it in a non-offensive way. I didn't bring up subjects like polygamy, but I said, this is the best biography out about Emma, and the whole purpose of the lesson was to try to get them to maybe have a more favorable view of Emma. And I think it was a lesson that worked well. I'm not one who thinks that the gospel doctrine time should be used for your favorite topic or self-help session. There is too little time and we know too little about our sacred text, but occasionally I think a deviation can be refreshing. Quickly, I just want to talk about some methods. First of all, I think one of the big problems in gospel doctrine teaching is that we don't have enough time. In my class, it usually ended up that we had like 30 minutes. And in 30 minutes, you're supposed to cover, like I said, all of Isaiah or something, or the whole book of Revelation. I mean, this is absurd. I think that if we're really going to have gospel learning and gospel study in the church, that we've got to rethink this. There are so many innovative things that we could do, but I'm afraid we get stuck in these patterns, and I don't know how to get out of them. I mean, obviously, all I know how to do is be a rebel and get released. But I think that there are things that we could do, and I think it's very sad that there's not more done there. I've already talked about close exegetical readings. This is my favorite approach. I found it worked very well. I like to use the Socratic method. One of my favorite lessons was a lesson that Fred gave on Alma 39. He did a very close reading of the text to show, and this actually was a response that he was trying to support what Paul had said, saying that fornication, he was saying that the text did not support the idea that fornication is next to murder. But as he did this close reading of the text, the thing that came out was that if you kill someone spiritually, that is on the same level as killing them physically. And I think that that's what the text is talking about. And that was a really interesting lesson for the class, to really go through closely in a text and say, what is it saying? If we really look at the words, can we give an interpretation here? So I think that's a great method to use. Lecture, I think, can work well. And one of the things I found is that I think a variety of approaches really is helpful for a class. Sometimes do a close exegetical reading. Another time, give a lecture. And it depends on what the topic is. For example, I gave a lesson on the restoration of the priesthood and, filled all the blackboard and wrote real small and sort of an untypical talk about the restoration of the priesthood. And I had a lot of men afterwards tell me that it was a fest and they liked it. I did another lecture on justification and sanctification that went over very well. Martin mentioned discussion. I think discussion is essential for teaching gospel doctrine well. And I see the main purpose is to get people to think, to get them to question, to get them to think about how does this text really, how does this affect me on a very deep level? And of course, there are many different kinds of discussions that you can have. I like to do, we had doctrinal discussions, we had discussions where we would bring up topical issues about, the suffering of children or things that are in the news. There are a lot of different kinds of discussions that you can have. Just a couple of things that we did that I thought worked. I already mentioned the Word of Wisdom lesson, which was a very successful one. We had a very heated discussion in our ward on grace and works. It started out with a lesson that Fred gave from the Book of Mormon. We got into a real debate. The next week, when it was my turn to teach, rather than going on to the next lesson, I brought up the topic again. And I'll tell you that that was, at least, it was hot, but at least there was no boredom in that class. I mean, the energy, the enthusiasm, it was exciting to get people to see that this question of grace and works was a very relevant one. It was a fun lesson. And in fact, that after that lesson, I tried to talk to the class about disagreeing and loving each other in spite of our disagreements, and I think that there were some positive things from it. There were a few people that were uncomfortable, but mostly I think people felt good about it. A couple of other examples. Fred would often bring in newspaper articles that were relevant and kind of jump off from there into a discussion. That worked very well. I did a lesson that I called Who is My Enemy, starting out with Jesus' statement, Who is My Neighbor? And I said, you know, Jesus asked this, but who is my enemy? This was from a DNC chapter that talked about the enemies of the church. And I brought in a news article on Deborah Lake to get the discussion going. Said, is she our enemy? And that was a wonderful discussion. I think it really made people think. I tried to encourage people to share their personal experiences. One of the things I tried to do was to share some of my doubts, some of my fears, some of the places that I feel like I fail in, to open up this feeling that you could, so there'll be a feeling that you could say anything. I think there are a lot of other methods of involving the class. One of my favorite lessons was a lesson that Fred Voros gave. We had come to the section of the Doctrine and Covenants, which talked about true and false revelation. So what Fred did was he started the class. He said, I have six revelations that I'm going to read to you. And he said, I'm not going to tell you where these things come from. And I want you to vote as a class whether you think this is a true or a false revelation. The things that he read were he read something from a DNC passage that was quite a few sections in the future that we hadn't come to yet. He had the 1976 Ensign Statement of President Kimball on war. He had a statement of Irville LeBaron. He had a statement from Thomas A. Kempis. He had a statement from the Apocrypha. And the interesting thing is that everyone immediately got very scared, you know, kind of looking, how was the person next to them voting, you know? And the funny thing, I laughed at this, there was one woman kind of shouted out, she said, I want to sit next to Margaret. And I kind of laughed at that. The 1976 statement of President Kimball got, I think, 50% of the class thought it wasn't a revelation. The Irville LeBaron was the only obvious one. He was a really bad revelator. It was all, Irville is great. The DNC passage was sort of voted down, like 70% thought it wasn't a revelation. It was amazing, but this was such a paradigm-shifting sort of experience. This idea of where is our certainty, how do we know? So that was a very interesting lesson. Another thing that Fred did one time that I thought was great was, I can't remember if it was a Christmas or an Easter lesson, where we just simply read the scriptures dealing with it. And he had us do choral readings. And it was so fun. It was very devotional. So I think there's a lot of different things that you can do. I've already said that I think the most important thing is to create an atmosphere of open thought and discussion. Taking a non-authoritarian approach, I tried to tell the class that, you know, when I thought this was just my opinion or when I was giving what I thought was the church's position, telling them that I didn't have to agree, that there are many different approaches. Finally, just for my conclusion, we often hear it said that growth is the biggest problem the church faces today. We hear this all the time. I disagree. I think it is death, spiritual death. People come into the church looking for spiritual life.
Instead, they find a poverty of spirit and a lack of knowledge. They come to church wanting to be fed, and they are given pablin, or worse, sugar water. They ask for bread and are given a stone. They seek for knowledge and are told they shouldn't ask questions. My assertion is that gospel doctrine cannot improve in the church until we change the climate in the church. We must have an atmosphere of freedom and grace if truth and love are to flourish. Thank you very much.
I've been a gospel doctrine teacher almost all of my adult life, except for the two times when I've been an elders quorum president. And certainly my teaching styles have changed over the years. Think of the first time when I was a freshman at BYU. And I'm embarrassed whenever I meet friends and remind me of those classes. It was Old Testament, and I started doing outside readings, and the text that I really used was not the scriptures, but the first 2,000 years by Leon Scott. And I was just thrilled about discovering all these little, you know, quotes by Brigham Young and all these other people about Adam, although they didn't quite go all the way to Adam God in that book. But and all these funny little things about, you know, how the earth was created with, you know, animals and plants being transplanted from other planets. And in addition to that, the style I adopted was a very common one among the freshmen in my ward. It was to get quite saccharine and emotional, and always at the end have the pitch in your voice raise, you know, and bear this, you know, you'd work yourself into, you can't bear your testimony in the same tone that you talked otherwise, and I've come to believe that that's not always so helpful. But then later I was still at BYU teaching gospel doctrine, and then I was into all these little gimmicks that teachers would use. You know, you teach them a little point that they need to remember for the week and work on, so you give them like a penny to put in their shoes, so every time they feel the penny, they'd remember the point. I'd always have all, you know, bring little pots where they plant a seed and have it grow in their apartment in school, and all these tricks. And it just my evolution as a teacher has been just so profound that I think back on that people would come up to you afterwards and tell you what a good lesson you had taught. Years ago, Sunstone published an article where a person was asking what was the worst job in the church, and he said, well, before we do the worst job, let's consider the best job in the church. And he went through and said, you know, bishop might be a good job because you get a lot of rewards and helping people and stuff, but too much work, you know, to make a good job. And scoutmaster might be a good job because everyone stands up when they go on their mission and says, I'm here because of my scoutmaster and that sort of stuff. But he says, the rewards are too delayed. You know? And the person concluded that the best job of the church was gospel doctrine teacher because regardless of how bad of a lesson you teach, someone is going to come up and tell you you gave a good lesson. And it's true. Another aspect of my early teaching was I was such a diligent student. I mean, I was more diligent about my gospel doctrine class than I was about any of my undergraduate studies. And I would just read all these books and try to, within a week, absorb all of this information and the implications of all these, and then give, you know, a 10-page detailed outline where you'd want to steamroll, you know, the class through this outline, and one can over prepare for a gospel doctrine class. And my preparation these days is, in terms of actually sitting down and what I'm going to do with the class, is very simple. But it comes from being able to draw upon years of reading the scriptures and years of reading commentaries and books about the scriptures, so-called higher criticism, and I don't even think of that when I'm reading the class, the preparing lesson, although I draw upon it when it comes up in the class. I agree with what people said before, that purpose of Sunday school is to help us learn how to be motivated and understand how better to live a Christian life. And it's not the same process that goes on in other places. I also distinguish, between Sunday school and my other classes that I've experienced teaching, which is priesthood, whereas priesthood takes a topic, is asking that particular question. Now, what I also do is I severely limit the main points that I want to have taken from the class. One or two. I no longer have this 5-10-page list of things the class needs to leave with. And I go, this is what I would like to have happen, the main points, the main interests. And then I have a tolerance when we go off into a certain discussion there, a certain discussion here, and sort of know where we're going. And it gives me a greater ease as being a teacher, because I'm not always trying to cut off a person's point and say, that's very interesting, but we've got to move on with my lesson, and which I think is not a helpful thing to do. I think that is a very helpful thing to do. I guess my approach to scriptures is so much informed by the historical critical methodology that I can't approach a text particularly, well, any text, but the Old and New Testaments, especially because that's what I've been teaching the last 2 years, without bringing them into the class. And yet, I want to bring them in class in a way that helps them live a better Christian life, but is honest to my understanding of scriptures without causing them to get to argue about some critical scholarship that doesn't matter at all to Christian living. Let me, for instance, share some case studies of what I've done recently. When we're teaching the book of Deuteronomy, which is really quite a boring book for a class to discuss, and I think the best one volume text of the book for the Old Testament, which is Bernard Anderson's book called Understanding the Old Testament. And I read that section, which gives me context. Then I read the text, and I often do read it first in a modern translation to sort of really understand what it's saying. And then it's almost impossible to teach from a modern translation as of being the primary text because of the resistance we have in the class. So I read the King James translation, which is much more intelligible to me, and I'm able to see verses that would spark out and say, oh, that really does say that, and I'm able to use them in a class. And then with Deuteronomy is supposedly this law that is dictated by Moses, but it is so preoccupied with living in the Holy Land. They're talking about boundary markers and all the things, the rules that arise when you're living in a landed, as a landed people, rather than a people on the move. And most scholars believe clearly that all these texts, were written by the people later and ascribed to Moses so that they would have the force of law to govern society. I came upon an approach to help people understand that and accept it in a way that was interesting. I told them, reminded them of Moroni being the prophet editor and how you can see his voice throughout the Book of Mormon. Sometimes he explicitly intervenes and reminds you who he is, and other times it's just sort of clear what he's doing and how he's doing commentary and thus we sees, and he's intervening and doing the moralizing. And I said, this is what most scholars see happens to a lot of the Bible text. It began as a tradition that was passed down orally, and the great Moroni of the Bible came after they returned from the Babylonian exile. They had to gather all their scriptures together, and some person had to pull them all together and summarize them and write them down. I said, some scholars say that was Ezra. They're not interested in history the way we're interested in, but in teaching the people of their day to live righteously. And then we go into the text and find these, you know, anachronisms in Deuteronomy, and we're able to discuss them and see how people who actually pulled that text together later were doing it in such a way to help the people who were hearing the text at that moment when it was read to them live a life here and now. And the concern was in history. And then we talked about how that's how we should deal. Anyhow, it was a fun lesson, and it was successful. Another lesson that I was able to do higher criticism and teach a class very well was Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, which kind of, you don't know what to do with them, you know. And what the church manual does is pick out the few things that sustain current church policy and views and ask us to quote those only Proverbs, which does real, you know, havoc to what they're all about. So the first thing I did when I went into the class was said, you know, we've got these little maxims in Mormonism today. Oh, let's list some. And people are listing, you know, every member a missionary, and no success can compensate for failure in the home, and that which we persist in doing becomes easier, not because the nature of it has changed, but because our ability to do it has increased. And we listed all of those, you know. And I said, you know, those are proverbs we live by today in our church. And then I said, you know, Israel considered that God spoke to people in three ways, you know, by the law through Moses, by the prophets, and then by wisdom literature, which lots of people had, and they would gather that wisdom literature together. And they considered it as revelation, but not on the same level they would Isaiah or Moses. And then with that larger context, you know, I had people quote the famous passages that they knew from Proverbs to sort of get them out of the way, and I just had them randomly open a section, and they read them, and what we distilled from that, though, was a respect for wisdom sayings that come from the grassroots of the people, which was, I think, a sort of fun thing to do, and kind of anti-hierarchical. And then move on to Proverbs, which basically says, Proverbs says, you know, I've tried all of these, you know, Benjamin Franklin Proverbs on how to live a good, practical life, and they don't work. Uh-huh. Oh, excuse me, Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes basically says, the moral wisdom of Proverbs doesn't work. You know, if you get up early, you know, you don't get the worm. And so we talked about that, and I said, it's incredible that, you know, he's an intellectual who is cynical, still believes in God, but doesn't understand anything about life, and it's not rational to him, and can't see anything about it. And then I asked the question, you know, given that this is scripture, how in the world did the cynic get in the scripture? You know, and we have such a fun discussion about that, you know, because it is there. And those are fun things. And finally, I'll give one last case study, was with King David coming to the throne. Someone the week before had dealt with his youth. And gave him a little historical background why King David was able to be such a successful political king because of the weakness of the kingdoms of to the north and south east of Israel at the time. He was able to fight off all of the enemies, have all these victories for the first time in history, have Israel not be subordinate to any other kingdom, and not for a very long time, actually. And he became such a great king because of those political battles. And he's really the first main king in Israel's history. Saul doesn't really matter. And he became the model of kings. And we talk about how kings are anointed, and there are people of God just like prophets, but they're different, and neither reported to each other, really, which was another anti-hierarchical point. And then talked about how the subsequent kings all were held to the model of David. And they were also called messiahs because they were anointed. And when the prophets would chastise the later kings, it's because they held him up to David and said, you're not as good as David. You're not doing what David did. You're not as faithful as David. And said, David becomes the model. The whole country changes the way America changed when Washington became the model. You know, everything before that didn't matter anymore. And then I said, and David is such an important model that even the readers of Jesus had to make a point that David was Jesus was of the line of David, which God promised all the leaders of Israel would come from the kings, and that he was had the title of David, Messiah, anointed, and all of that. And then that was really fun because it helped them understand Messiah and all of that stuff. But then I posed him a really fun question, which was, given the fact that David is such an important central figure and became the model for everyone, even Jesus, how is it then that Israel recorded his life so humanly and whole, so fallibly? You know, the United States didn't do that with George Washington, and the Mormon Church doesn't do that with Joseph Smith. That comment made a high councilman a little unhappy, but that's a fun question. But you know, you ask the question that people can understand them in a faithful context that lead to us dealing with our humanness and the Spirit and God. And anyhow, that's sort of how I approach teaching gospel doctrine. I have a few ideas, grapple with the text. Sometimes I just have to summarize the narrative and go through it and hit the main points and ask one or two questions that are open-ended and deal with issues. And I had a real hard time. For a year or so, I was really tentative about closing in the name of Jesus Christ because I had read a commentary on the Ten Commandments, which says the commandment not to take the Lord's name in vain really doesn't mean swearing. What they were talking about was not speaking for the Lord when you're not really speaking for the Lord. And that commandment has more of a application to the priest of Israel, who would say, "Thus saith God," and this sort of stuff, than they do for everyday person. And so I was really nervous about saying something was God when it may have just been my opinion. But not closing in the name of Jesus Christ makes the class very uncomfortable. And so I have come around to the fact of working to a point where I find a principle which I really do believe in, and I bear testimony of that principle, but I don't seal my whole lesson in the name of Jesus Christ. And I don't know if they pick up on that subtlety, but it eases my conscience. The time's up, but that's sort of where I am with gospel teaching. It's a serious taking of the text, and as questions come up, I draw upon my lessons, and sometimes the lesson goes off in a whole direction. I'm drawing upon my reading, and everyone comes up to me and says, "Wow, how long did it take you to prepare for the lesson?" And, you know, the short answer is, I read this text an hour before church, you know, and that's the first time I looked at it this week. But the long answer is all of my life, you know. And if you don't want to have rushed feelings, and if you're not going to have the feeling that you're cramming things down people's throats or shoehorning great ideas you read during that week into the lesson, then it just needs to be the product of a lifelong talking and thinking and pondering and reading, so that it just sort of comes out as it does in all of our other conversations. And when that happens, you're able then to be conversational in class and very easy with the flow of lessons. And I think it makes for a much better discussion and listen altogether. Thank you.
I hope you're having as much fun as I am. I appreciate you all very much and have very much enjoyed your comments. Some of mine will be repetitive, so I may do a little cutting so we have some extra time to talk. We have left time to talk, but maybe some extra, because I think you're hearing some common themes here. We do a lot of things the same. Let me start by sharing with you a quotation that has guided my teaching for years. And I've taught gospel doctrine for quite a few years, at the gospel doctrine adult level in Houston for years. Teenagers, my gosh, there are Houston faces in the back. And taught teenagers in Seattle, and now gospel doctrine, and going toward the third year of teaching in Seattle. And this is something I read some time ago that has guided my teaching, by Donald Marquis from Chapters for the Orthodox. "All religion, all life, all art, all expression come down to this: to the effort of the human soul to break through its barrier of loneliness, of intolerable loneliness, and make some contact with another seeking soul,
or with what all souls seek, which is, by any other name, God. I am trying in my classes to create an atmosphere in which people can connect with other seeking souls and can face their own seeking soul, can find it and face it, and then to seek together, and that we might all come to know God better. I don't think there's anything more important to do in the church. And so a little bit about what I try to do, always trying to learn, because you sure can always get a whole lot better. I've taken notes. I'm going to try some techniques I've picked up today. Because how to do it falls basically in two categories, and one is how to teach a somewhat captive and unwilling audience, too much material and too little time, and what to teach. The universal principles of teaching are the same. It doesn't matter whether you're teaching gospel doctrine or physics. It's the same. First, the teacher must know the material, and I can't echo Elbert's comment enough. That means you start now, if you haven't already, trying to learn the material. And it takes a lifetime and probably an eternity, and so we get on with it and prepare ourselves to try to teach when the opportunity arises and to learn always. And the other is you've got to know where your students are. You must do a task analysis. You cannot take people from point A to point Z very well. You really do have to go from point A to point B. And in your class, you'll find a range, and it'll differ with each class. I've certainly found that to be true. And so what you can teach, how deep you can get, will be dictated somewhat by your class. And then you have to look at the whole range and find a way to meet as many of those needs as you can. And that's not always easy. There will be a fair number of people there who are there only because there isn't enough time between Priesthood Relief Society and sacrament meeting to go home, and the only couch in the foyer is full. So here they are. And so your first line of attack with them is to make it plain that you love the subject. And if they'll come along with you, you promise you'll allow them to take home something of worth. And so you're a bit of a huckster. I think church teachers have to be. Because of the way we're told to teach, the amount of material we have to cover, the wide range of people. And so it really does help to be a bit of a huckster. And the good test is, if you're interested, excited by what you're going to cover, they probably will be too. And if you aren't, start over, because they are not going to be. I establish rules at the outset, and for me the outside is the call to serve. And when a bishop asks me to teach, I sit down with him and we talk. And I say, I'd love to do this, but you need to know how I teach. I've been trying to know the gospel for 30 years, and I bring with me a head full of some knowledge. It's painfully little, and the more I know it's painfully little. But it will come out. I cannot teach to the manual alone. I simply cannot with integrity. I don't know how to do that. And so if you're calling me, you're getting me. You're getting this head, you're getting this heart, and I'll give it all I have. But if you ask me to teach directly to the manual and directly to the scriptures, which I can't do because like the other panelists here, I do know some higher criticism. I do know some other translations, and I just can't see it the way some people can. I don't think you can say you can teach to the scriptures and there's only one way. I try to convey that it is not an arrogant position, but it is really of a fellow seeker of God. But if you want me, you have me, but you have me. And I invite them to come to my classes. Please come to my class. Please add whatever criticisms, comments you have publicly. I can take that. Privately, I don't care. I'll be glad to listen to you, and I'll be glad to weigh that. But when it comes down to you cannot bring in any other materials or you cannot discuss controversial topics, then I must resign. And these are the ground rules as we start out. And it's worked very well. And they generally come and line up against the wall and you know, sit there for a few weeks or months. And then occasionally they'll come in. But it's worked very, very well for me. My class is based on two principles. One is that anything true is from God. That the religious person should never be afraid to thoroughly research for the truth. All truth is from God. And second, that faith and knowledge are two essential and complementary elements of life. Faith is neither knowledge nor a blind religious substitute for knowledge. Faith is less than knowledge, as when fact confirms and we have no need of faith. Faith is more than knowledge, as when conviction goes outside the fixed limits of our very finite human knowledge. And so we seek knowledge in every possible corner, because we cannot be saved in ignorance, and because the more knowledge we gain, the more we know we must live by faith. That is a central philosophy of how I approach gospel doctrine. I use everything I can get my hands on, from New Yorker cartoons to folk songs to rock songs to many, many years of collecting articles from many sources. Now with Old Testament, I'm using a lot of biblical archaeological reviews, a lot of old pictures. I think they help. I think when you bring in a picture of the tombs of the First Temple period at the time of Solomon, and people can see how they are architecturally patterned after the cedars of London, of Lebanon, as they were used in the temple, and how even the grain of the wood was carved into that stone in the caves underneath for burial, that it helps people to see. I think when you share that Abraham's purchase of the cave at Machpelah actually was according to Hittite law, I think it helps people to see, gosh, these really might have been real people with real problems, real situations. I think it's very important to bring in that kind of material and humanize and make real and make historical the Old Testament in particular. Rule two. I respect you, you respect me, and we will respect each other. And you've heard this said better than I can today, but I want to reiterate it again. It is extremely important. Any opinion is welcome in my class. Any opinion may be challenged, but no opinion maker may be belittled. Period. I will stop it instantly. I will speak up for that person if he has just said black is white. We simply cannot tolerate that, because then we can't be a society of seekers. So that is very, very important. We learn best from people who treat us as individuals and who seem to care about us. And the teacher has to set that tone so that it will go through the class, hopefully. It is not always easy, and this is one of the hardest things you do. There's a gentleman in my class who's a convicted child abuser. Everyone in the ward knows about it. A good deal of the ward has had experience either caring for those seven children after the abuse and realizing the great damage done. And he likes to pontificate about how to raise children. And I can watch the body language in my class. The people stiffen and they have to hold themselves down. I can't show any of that body language. I cannot do that. And when I see it out there, it's important that I diffuse it. We have to stay to his comments. The merit of his comments alone, and there's no way we can allow the personal feelings. Believe me, that climate could be undone in a flash if people didn't understand. And I've even had to speak to some of the people in the class who were foster parents and say, I can see you're in pain. I can see it. I see it in the class. I know what you're feeling. Please help me. What would you accomplish by speaking out and damning this man? So that is extremely important. No one's allowed to monopolize the conversation. And so if you have a monopolizer, and don't we all, there are several usually, but there's always one. You simply have to get bold about it sometimes and say, Sister Smith, I'd really love to hear from you, but I need to hear from more people. And if no one, other hands are up, and there's Sister Smith with her hand up and wondering, you know, I just call on someone. I mean, you really have to set the tone that we want to hear from everyone. And the Sister Smiths really do respect it. I found that those people tend to keep coming. They understand they will get their turn. They will be treated fairly, but they won't be allowed to monopolize it. We take on vulnerability only when we think we have more to gain than to lose. And so if you're going to create an atmosphere where vulnerability is expected and okay, and people understand that if we let out our warts and our doubts and our questions, the teacher has to set the tone for that too. You have to admit when you're wrong, and you will be, and you have to talk about your own questions, and you have to talk about where you may have made an error in raising your children or whatever. And you have to expose a little of your blood for people to feel it really is safe to expose some of theirs. And I think they will do that. Another rule is what we are learning does not always apply to us today, at least not obviously or not yet. We cannot twist everything that we're there to learn into a lesson for how to live my life. Some of it is information that enriches our life. I teach basically a lecture and discussion class with a lot of scripture reading. I agree we are seemingly almost impervious to learning at times. We don't know our scriptures. We don't. As a group, we don't. And so I find I have to do scripture reading in order that we're talking about the same thing. We get some common ground here. And I find I have to read a longer session than is called for in the manual because they're so often out of context. There's no other way. So we'll deal with fewer of those sections, but we're going to deal with the whole issue. We're going to try to deal with it in context. And I tend to start to lecture because I want us to have a common beginning, so that we can start from the same point. But I try to have a discussion in each class. Not always. Occasionally it'll be all lecture, and then we'll come back and we'll do discussion. I'm willing to change the order of the manual, and I'm willing to say it is so important that we come back and we deal with Proverbs again, or that we are sure that we do understand the Mosaic Law, that we may skip a little, and there's no way I can cover 1,000 years of history and 40, 50 pages of scripture in half an hour. It cannot be done. Occasionally I'll try, and then we'll do just a whole lecture and we'll go like crazy. But you can't do a good deal with that. I want multiple manuals. If anyone gets this tape to check us out, please, I want multiple manuals. I want them on different levels. I want them on different subjects. I want a course in a year study of Isaiah. I want a course in a year study of the writings. I want some option. I agree wholeheartedly with Margaret that we can't just go through the scriptures like this. We don't get it in enough depth. A couple months at least on the Psalms, at least. Please. I would very much like to have a whole course on the Pauline letters, or a whole course on the gospel, the gospels. I'd like to have a reinstitution of the old instructor magazine. I still have a few of those. I bought when I was young. I don't know if anyone else still goes back. I want a new type of instructor magazine. I want some discussion about real ideas of how we can teach and sources we can use and some real helps for the teacher. I want people like the best gospel doctor not class I ever attended, Tony Kimball's. If any of you were ever in the Cambridge ward and heard the gospel according to C.S. Lewis, or as those of us in the class gratefully nicknamed his wonderful gospel doctrine class, I would just love to have, more than the brief article Tony did write about C.S. Lewis and how he approached it, and more about his teaching. It would be wonderful to focus on some of the teachers who do a spectacular job and who handle some very interesting, pertinent information. I'd also like to have an encouragement for team teaching so we have time to do this. This is if you do this job right, it's a backbreaker. And it would be so nice to be able to do it that way. I also see a role for Sunstone, for the other periodicals of interest, and Mormon scholars in general. We need some material. When's the last time you saw a piece of exegesis in Sunstone or Dialogue? Or it's not there, because that's not what we're doing. We need that. We lay teachers, we lay people just trying to learn. We fellow members of the church really do need that kind of material, and we do have to go totally outside the Mormon community to get all of it. We'd love to have it. We'd also at least like to know where people are doing other work. I was recently made aware that a BYU professor, for the first time a BYU professor has been given Dead Sea Scrolls to translate. I would love to see that work published in a place where I can access it as a Mormon and not have to go searching through where Dead Sea Scrolls are published. It's a great honor for a Latter-day Saint to have that responsibility, and we should know about it, and we should know about the fruits of his labor. So you who specialize in Middle Eastern history and all, I hope some, or classics or whatever, sometime in your research, I hope that you'll follow what must be a hobby for you to look at the religious component of what you do and help those of us who'd like to have more material by Mormon authors. Now, what would you like to discuss with us?
I just want to say thank you to all the speakers. I would like to be attending I want to just say something as having a number of years of experience teaching, though I'm not teaching now. I like the metaphor of the glass of water. And I don't think we can fill our students, our brothers and sisters' heads full of all the knowledge. Maybe that's why we're doing this every 4 years. Maybe that's why we have to have a wide angle shot. Sometimes we zoom in on some verses, and we're not going to have a close up with every verse. Let me just pass on a suggestion to anybody who wants to use it. When I was teaching the Old Testament 4 years ago, I knew that Psalms was going to be coming up. So at the beginning of the year, I asked the members of the class to participate in each person selecting a psalm at the beginning of the class. So anybody at the beginning of each class session, a different class member had selected a psalm of their own choice. They shared it with us at the beginning of the class that week. It was kind of like a devotional setting. As the roll went around that week, we listed the psalms that had already been shared with us in class, read aloud, so people would know the ones that had already been done. And by the time we got the psalms, people had a better experience with it because they'd already searched them on their own. Even had a learning disabled person reading psalms to us and parts of the psalm to us in his own impaired voice. But I just throw that out as an idea if anybody wants to.
On the question of more material and more access to more exegetical stuff, I've been astonished in the electronic mail domain how much some people know about really arcane things. And you'll get into the Out of God discussion. I'm just blown away what people know out there. So, and a few other things. And there ought to be an electronic distribution list, or whatever they're called, a bulletin board, for gospel doctrine teachers. And Elmer could, you know, start preparing a week earlier for his hour and send out a message of, you know, the five things that y'all ought to read this week. And here's a few things you might think of. And, Margaret, you know, we could have a phenomenal discussion for a week before class, and we'd all give incredible lessons.
Wonderful idea.
Not at all hard.
Anecdote under the heading of things you've heard, thou shalt not belittle, thou shalt deal with monopolizers. I would like your reactions to an actual event. Helen Hinckley Jones, the late Helen Hinckley Jones, one of the longtime most revered gospel doctrine teachers in Southern California, as this happened. Brother B had no subject that he cared about other than worrying about when he died whether he would be resurrected in his old frail condition now, or whether he would be resurrected in his prime. And no matter what the lesson was, that was what his comment was about. And that was incessant. Now, Helen Hinckley Jones was a wonderful woman with a very ample body. And one day, she lost it. And she said, Brother B, I don't know about you, but I do not want all of me resurrected. It had consequences. It violated Mark's principle. Brother B stayed away from church for quite a few months. He eventually came back. But what's your reaction?
What is my reaction to the teacher saying, I've had it, son? Okay. There, we all have our crosses to bear, and any of us who've taught for any amount of time will find those crosses in our classrooms. I would have handled it very differently, but What can I say? I'm from the Lower East Side. We either kill him or we put up with him. So since the end of my pagan days, I've been trying to put. I mean, in a situation, what would I have done? I might have pulled the person. I'm a psychotherapist, for heaven's sake. I'd pull the guy aside and get into his stuff with him, you know, and look at it, do it that way. Because I think this is a superb example of a person speaking from fear. And I think it needs to be dealt with not on some kind of up here cognitive level, but deep in here where the fear is. And if you don't do that, you know, I mean, I'm glad the guy came back. I could easily have imagined a situation where he wouldn't have gotten the high power scope rifle, go to the top of a water tower. Ugh, yuck. So that's how I'd respond to it. Further? No? Okay.
Yes, sir.
I have a response to that. I think it comes down to deciding whose class it is. If the teacher, regardless of how good the teacher is, if he or she decides it's her class and this person takes the same 20-second narrative and it kind of gets in the way of my class, then there's going to be a problem. You have to say, hey, if the class is class, they have the same crossfire as I do, we have to listen to this for 30 seconds. What's 30 seconds? And you can blow it right off. It's not a problem.
Can you speak loudly? We want to hear you.
I want to say thank you to the contributors here today for raising an additional question. So we've been using an agenda that is a typewritten sheet. But if we go through this routine agenda, item one is identical to the other from classmate week or state conference. Number two is to stop long enough share what they did about last week's discussion. And then go on to a quick encapsulation of all the stuff that's in the meetings. And then focus on specifically one paragraph or one chapter that is topical, fits with the subject matter, newspaper, whatever is going on. And then the next item is how do we apply what we learned in 1994? Then take time to help people jot down a personal or family objective to apply that during the week. And then the next week, we start with last week. Is that too much of an effort to intrude into their lives and help them set their shape up and do it their way?
No, that's a very useful approach, but it's one approach, and that doesn't leave you time for a class of lecture or a class of, and it's something that should be done sometimes, I think. Can be very useful.
Now, just a question. A number of you brought up higher criticism. I wonder to what degree this is being taught in the church, at least to the Brigham Young University, perhaps. Is there a church policy on this or anything like that?
Albert, do you know the answer to that?
The question was, how much of higher criticism is being taught in the church educational system? Some. You read the church's manuals, and anything that tries to give you a historical context for the Old Testament or something is the historical critical methodology. And there are professors at BYU who are very informed on that, and many of them even go beyond that. They are very selective in what they use. Any kind of critical scholarship that contradicts what we consider the revealed teachings of the church is not used. And so that means anything that would, say, challenge the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch or that looks at Revelation in an environmental context. Those are things you wouldn't find in church curriculum. And outside of some historical background, there is almost, my experience, very little to none. The greatest disillusionment I had was after having taken 4 semesters, 2 of Old Testament and 2 of New Testament, and then after my graduation from BYU, living in Washington, D.C., A group of friends and I decided to form an Old Testament study group to complement the gospel doctrine class that year, and we went with a friend to the bookstore at Catholic University who was studying biblical studies, and he pointed out all these books we should take, and we started reading them. One of them was Bernard Anderson's Understanding the Old Testament, and it just floored me that there's this whole world of scholarship and college classes at BYU never even attempted to introduce that to me. Whereas if I'd taken a psychology class, they would have tried to introduce me to every kind of psychological approach. We teach seminary classes and give them college credit at BYU, and we don't teach any critical methodology, to speak of, at BYU. And I was really disillusioned, and it's the only time I've been furious about my education at BYU, and I was cheated, and they owe me my money back.
My question is, how would you deal with reproof or correcting people? I know that sometimes, and we don't like to do it, but sometimes it comes up. I mean, when you're teaching adults, I was teaching younger people, but sometimes it seems to me that there comes a situation where there's reproof or correction that is... even in the form of illumination or further information, and you can do it politely, but it's obvious that it's being done and that it happens, where a person takes a position that seems pretty egregiously wrong, and it's hurting people in the class. Now, you kind of mentioned something like this, but I remember an instance where a fellow would just continue to claim that, you know, if people simply work hard, they will have enough money. You know, just a preposterous linear concept of if you keep the commandments, you will prosper in a very narrow sense. And there are people all around who have kept the commandments, who have not prospered, and who are just weighted down with feelings of inadequacy, and you can see it happening. How do you as teachers deal with some kind of situation like that? I mean, you've already expressed taking them aside, but that doesn't help the people who don't hear the correction. You see what I'm kind of saying? How do you deal with that kind of situation?
If I can just rephrase it for the tape, how do you deal with it when somebody brings up some ridiculously simplistic idea like, well, you know, if those folks just work hard enough, they'd have all the money they'd need and be healthy too? Okay. You got it. The way I deal, and of course there is great harm that can go into that, because if it isn't obvious by now, one would have to be truly, truly organically harmed to not realize that principle simply does not work, and people can be made to feel very small. What I do, what I would do in a situation like that, is I would look for the kernel of that I could agree with first. That's where I start and say, you know, I think I can see where you're coming from. I mean, there are perhaps these or that examples, and we all, of course, want to get into kind of a self-reliant frame and mode here. So the person starts agreeing with me because I'm recognizing at least a portion of what they're saying. Then I will bring up a slew of scriptural examples that show that this argument completely collapses, but I'll be nice about it. Okay? And I'll say, but, you know, what would you do with somebody like Job, you know? I mean, there he is, worked hard all his life, earthquake, death, destruction, he's out of it. Okay? Where do you put somebody like that? You know? Or how do we deal, but at all times, I never make it an argument between the two of us, and I never make it a, you know, you're really wrong. You know, I really try to keep the personality out of it and say, we all have something to learn here. Part of it is the principle you've just brought up, but as Lehi taught, reality is complicated. It's not me teaching it, it's Lehi teaching it. So let's look at the flip side of it too, that we have to integrate into that. Now, if they're truly, truly going to be difficult about it, and then they have to argue with the scripture, not with me. That's how I deal with it. Further reflections? No?
Well, the only thing I would add to my question is, what if the person...